Spiritual Sabbath. Does the gospel supply an answer to the Christian dilemma? Paul writes that the Sabbath celebrated by the Jews is an allegorical representation of the Sabbath, as seen in his words that it is a shadow of things to come, call 217 KJV. The Gospels are spiritual writings, and they often intentionally conflict with what would be understood from a literal or historical perspective, in order to force the reader to seek the spiritual meaning. The prediction was that the Son of Man would be 3 days in the tomb, and yet, if you count the days as reported in the Scriptures, they are 2. And this is because the Christians who read the Scriptures in the manner of the Pharisees who threw away the key of knowledge, not only do not understand the spiritual meaning of the 3 days, but they further do not understand the portrayal of a Sabbath following the Passover. They therefore attempt to doctrinally force the interpretation the following day after the Sabbath as the first day of the week, or for those who worship the Sun God in the manner of the pagan Christians, Sunday. On the other hand, the Greek word used to describe the day of the supposed resurrection is miaton sabbaton, or, if literally translated, one of the Sabbaths. But the conflict over the day of the week is seen in the Christians' inability to understand what is meant by one of the Sabbaths, which is exactly how the Greek text reads. And the grave misunderstanding of most Bible readers is seen when they fail to perceive that the allegorical symbol of the Sabbath is not the actual Sabbath that is the objective of the Scriptures, which is portrayed in the biblical term, one of the Sabbaths. As noted in many places in this article, Eden is the embodiment of the Sabbath, and it is the return to Eden while still alive in the body. See, that is the true objective of the Scriptures and the teachings of Jesus and the way. From a true spiritual perspective, the Jews have never celebrated a Sabbath, and what they observe is an allegorical portrayal of the Sabbath that they lack the depth of understanding to comprehend the meaning of. And this reality, which is not understood by either the Jews or the pagan Christians, is also presented in the meaning of the verse that was removed from the Gospel of Luke by the sun-worshipping Christians, that is, on the same day, he, Jesus, beholding a man laboring on the Sabbath, said to him, "Man, if thou knowest what thou doest, blessed art thou. If, however, thou dost not know, cursed art thou, and a transgressor of the law." See, if the Passover is correctly embraced from a spiritual perspective, see, in contradistinction to the allegorical Passover of the Jews, then the disciple has overcome and achieved the next level of birth, and to him, there is nothing but Sabbaths. After the celebration of the true Sabbath, which can only be accomplished in the fulfillment of the laws within oneself, there is no more counting of days, weeks, months, and years, that is. But now, after you have known God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements, to which you desire again to be in bondage? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I am afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain. Gal 4:9-11 NKJ. The Pharisees, who were condemned because of their carnal and ritualistic interpretation of the Scriptures, celebrate an allegorical Sabbath that is of the flesh, that is, what Paul portrays as a shadow of the true Sabbath that is spiritual. The disciples of Jesus are to strive to bring about the true spiritual Sabbath of completion, and after you achieve this spiritual Sabbath, there is no more days of the week, but only the abiding eternal rest. And this is why the Sabbath is portrayed as following the Passover in the Gospels, and the next day is portrayed as one of the Sabbaths, among other things. What this means is that there is absolutely no basis for observing the day of the Sun God, that is, Sunday, except, of course, if you worship the Sun God in the manner of the pagan Church of Rome. And the fact that you can't count the days where the Son of Man was in the tomb 3 days and make it the day of the Sun God, simply because you read the Scriptures in the same manner as the Pharisees, totally alienates the believers of the Church from even the very objects and spiritual essence of the teachings of Jesus and the way. Received the law from angels, the two creation accounts, because the deists understood both the laws and the purpose of what was being conveyed in the two allegorical creation accounts in Genesis. They understood that in the same way that the father did not come rushing to the aid of his prodigal son when his son was in great need and being exploited by what Jesus portrayed as the citizen of the far country, neither does Creator God tweak the laws that were put into effect prior to God resting on the spiritual Sabbath. Faith-based believers not only fail to understand the reason there is two creation accountants in Genesis, but neither do they understand the true spiritual reality of the Sabbath. Creator God's work was completed in what is allegorically portrayed as the Sabbath and being complete. There was no more work to be accomplished. Therefore, not only does the Genesis account portray Creator God's work as being completed on the Sabbath, but what is presented as God in the second creation account portrays God in a different name. God's presence, therefore, in all that follows the initial creation account, is in fact the movement of God's laws and the natural forces of creation that was put into effect, and this is confirmed in the disciples' statement that allegorically, the Jews were a people who had received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. Acts 7:53 NKJV. But what does this mean? Allegorically, the angels are representative of the personification of the law, so it wasn't that a supernatural being handed the law over to Moses, but rather, that in the development of mind signified in the allegory of the text, the elevated consciousness enabled the mind to see, perceive, and understand the higher reality of the laws that organic man is blind to.
That,
as Paul states, they have not kept it, is because they have failed to bring about the completion of the Sabbath. In further making reference to the law, Paul writes, "For if the message spoken by angels was binding, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment." Heb 2:2 NIV. When the laws that were put into effect are understood, perhaps the best way to portray these laws that the deists portrayed as the laws of nature and nature's God is as a spiritual biofeedback machine that dynamically evolves each soul to perfection by intimately responding to our every action, reaction, and failure to act and responds appropriately when the time is opportune for our greatest learning and advancement. But these laws were put into action in the Alpha of creation, and are the perfect works of Creator God that is dynamically designed to movement of man as a reality of the laws that the core deists attempted unsuccessfully to convey to the theists and organized religion. The punishment that Paul makes reference to is the effect of the laws returning to each person the fruit of their own past actions, that is, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Gal 6:7 NIV. Peter states of the two princes, "See the double-edged sword of the law and the left hand of God." But that this is so has been said even by the law and the person of God. "I will kill,"
and
"I will make alive," "I will strike,"
and
"I will heal." For in truth, he kills and makes alive. He kills through the left hand, that is, through the evil one, who has been so composed as to rejoice in afflicting the impious. And he saves and benefits through the right hand, that is, through the good one, who has been made to rejoice in the good deeds and salvation of the righteous.
And thus,
when understood, it is the left hand of God that is the power of correction and returns to each person the substance of their own actions and, on a secondary note, the substance of their thoughts and desires. Therefore it can be said, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he," Prov 23:7. And his experiences of life are limited by the substance of the thoughts which he entertains. In the same manner, a person of wisdom knows that there is a left and a right to all things, and the left hand of the Scriptures is the written word of the Scriptures, which Paul portrayed as the letter that killeth, 2 Cor 3:6, while the right hand is the inner meaning that lies concealed beneath the allegorical cloak of the texts. And in the same way that the prince and power of correction lies with the left hand, that is, the left hand of God, see the written word portrays the left hand of God, which is explained in greater detail in a later subheading entitled Time and the Left Hand of God. The natural organic people of the earth who dwell under the dominion of the citizen of the far country, that is, those who have yet to put on the required wedding garment and come to the call, remain blind to both the spirit and the inner meaning of the Scriptures. Jesus portrayed this organic human blindness as the outer darkness of mind and being, see outer darkness, which parallels Plato's account of the cave, see Plato's cave, and it is representative of the natural condition of the laws which limit each person to the thought vibrations of their heart and mind. On the other hand, those who perpetrate evil actions on their brothers and sisters dwell in that condition which is maintained by the laws in what Jesus portrayed as the prison. The Apostle Peter warns that the enigmas of the scriptures, which he portrays as the mystery of the books with the power to deceive, were intentionally inserted into the body of the text as a test to the reader. Man, whose condition is maintained by the laws in accord with the thoughts of the heart, is tested throughout the scriptures to see if he has prepared himself to be of a greater vision and understanding of what he perceives out of the written word. Speaking of Simon Magus's ability to deceive the people, Peter is quoted as stating in the homilies, and with us, indeed, who have it handed down from our forefathers the worship of the God who made all things, and also the mystery of the books which are able to deceive, he will not prevail, but with those from amongst the Gentiles who have the polytheistic fancy bred in them, and who know not the falsehoods of the scriptures, he will prevail much. And not only he, but if any other shall recount to those from among the Gentiles any vain, dreamlike, richly set out story against God, he will be believed, because from their childhood their minds are accustomed to take in things spoken against God. And few there shall be of them, as a few out of a multitude, who through ingenuousness shall not be willing so much as to hear an evil word against the God who made all things. And to these alone from amongst the Gentiles it shall be vouchsafed to be saved. Let not any one of you, therefore, altogether complain of Simon, or of any one else, for nothing happens unjustly, since even the falsehoods of Scripture are with good reason presented for a test. With respect to what Peter portrays as the falsehoods of the Scriptures, Moses Maimonides, one of the most respected of Jewish theologians, historian, and Talmudist, writes about the nature of Scripture. Every time that you find in our books a tale the reality of which seems impossible, a story which is repugnant to both reason and common sense, then be sure that the tale contains a profound allegory veiling a deeply mysterious truth, and the greater the absurdity of the letter, the deeper the wisdom of the spirit. And what this means is that when the reader encounters an evil word against the God and believes the allegorical falsehood, then this person has failed the test, and his heart and mind remains hardened by the laws which return to each person the thoughts of their own heart. Peter portrays the Gentiles as being easily deceived because they are accustomed to believing bad things about God. Thus, the God of the Old Testament has been insightfully portrayed as resembling the Wizard of Oz, that is, a magical nutcase behind the curtain who liked physical circumcision, genocide of non-Jews, including killing every woman and child, a God who made man, then repented he ever made man and killed everyone on earth but Noah's and his immediate family, a God who kills a man for trying to steady the ark, a voodoo God who loves animal sacrifice and blood sprinkling, a God who sacrifices his son instead of himself. The scriptures are very clear. It's all allegorical about the kingdom within. The reader is warned in John 6:63, that reading the scriptures literally has no profit at all, the flesh profiteth nothing, and leaves the reader spiritually bankrupt. It is the spirit that quickeneth, the flesh profiteth nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit, and they are life. Deists believed in the pre-existent soul that evolves to perfection over many lifetimes. The encyclopedia names two of the most influential founding fathers of the United States and presents the fact that Benjamin Franklin believed in reincarnation or resurrection, and then states that others such as Thomas Paine were agnostic about the immortality of the soul. I trouble not myself about the manner of future existence. I content myself with believing, even to positive conviction, that the power that gave me existence is able to continue it in any form and manner he pleases, either with or without this body. And it appears more probable to me that I shall continue to exist hereafter than that I should have had existence, as I now have, before that existence began. Thomas Paine, The Age of Reason, Part 1, Recapitulation. Because the encyclopedia authors do not themselves understand the teaching of Jesus on the higher reality of the soul, see Gospel of Thomas saying 82, the encyclopedia author does not understand why Paine was not concerned with the immortality of the soul as would be commonly understood. Paine understood the higher reality of the soul and understood that the higher soul self is eternal. In understanding that each of us is an embryonic image of our higher soul self, Thomas Paine was concerned with the work of this life, that is, the expansion and required next phase of birth of the image that is implanted in the body vessel at conception, explored in soul image. But Paine then goes on to write, "But all other arguments apart, the consciousness of existence is the only conceivable idea we have of another life, and the continuance of that consciousness is immortality. The consciousness of existence, of the knowing that we exist, is not necessarily confined to the same form, nor to the same matter, even in this life. We have not in all cases the same form, nor in any case the same matter that composed our bodies 20 or 30 years ago, and yet we are conscious of being the same persons. That the consciousness of existence is not dependent on the same form or the same matter is demonstrated to our senses in the works of the creation, as far as our senses are capable of receiving that demonstration. A very numerous part of the animal creation preaches to us, far better than Paul, the belief of a life hereafter. Their little life resembles an earth and a heaven, a present and a future state, and comprises, if it may be so expressed, immortality in miniature. The most beautiful parts of the creation to our eye are the winged insects, and they are not so originally. They acquire that form and that inimitable brilliancy by progressive changes. The slow and creeping caterpillar worm of today passes in a few days to a torpid figure in a state resembling death, and in the next change comes forth in all the miniature magnificence of life, a splendid butterfly, the age of reason." In an essay, Mr. Paine wrote the following short and to the point passage, "I consider myself in the hands of my Creator, and that he will dispose of me after this life consistently with his justice and goodness. I leave all these matters to him, as my creator and friend, and I hold it to be presumption in man to make an article of faith as to what the creator will do with us hereafter." Quoted at Deism and Death. Further, the following is a selection of quotes from Thomas Paine concerning the afterlife. "My own opinion is, that those whose life have been spent in doing good, and endeavoring to make their fellow mortals happy, for this is the only way in which we can serve God, will be happy hereafter, and that the very wicked will meet with some punishment. This is my opinion. It is consistent with my idea of God's justice and with the reason God has given me." From a theological essay on deism, "We, deists, believe in the existence of God and in the immortality of the soul." From another essay on deism, "The idea of a future state was a universal idea to all nations except the Jews. At the time, and long before Jesus Christ was born, it had been sublimely treated of by Cicero, by Plato, Socrates, Xenophon, and others of the ancient theologians, whom the abusive Catholic Church calls heathen." From reply to the Bishop of Llandaff, "I trouble not myself about the manner of future existence. I content myself with believing, even to positive conviction, that the power that gave me existence is able to continue it in any form and manner he pleases, either with or without this body." From the Age of Reason. To recap an important point, in the 17th and 18th centuries, spiritual Gnostics were called deists, and when rightfully understood, their objectives were exactly the same as presented in the above quotation from the Encyclopedia Britannica under the heading, "The History of Christian Mysticism," where it reads, "Although the essence of mysticism is the sense of contact with the transcendent, mysticism in the history of Christianity should not be understood merely in terms of special ecstatic experiences, but as part of a religious process lived out within the context of the Christian community. From this perspective, mysticism played a vital part in the early church. Early Christianity was a religion of the spirit that expressed itself in the heightening and enlargement of human consciousness. And it is this heightening and enlargement of human consciousness which was the essence of early spiritual Christianity, was and is in fact the core objective of deism as defined above and demonstrated in the words. A religious and philosophical belief that a supreme God created the universe, and that this and other religious truth can be determined using reason and observation of the natural world alone. The deists and masons surrounded themselves with symbols of higher consciousness and in the objective of enlightening their understanding of what they perceived and comprehended, they developed their mind with depth and balance. The holographic pattern of the 12 within the one, the reality that both our modern faith-based religions and the pseudo-intellectuals fail to understand, was that if the proper conditions were present, The laws would bring about a higher reality among the people, and this is crucial to even begin to understand both the success of the American people and what the critics of the United States often condemn as the concept of American exceptionalism. Enlightened spiritual seekers have all witnessed to mankind that creation is imbued with a divine pattern that is holographic, that is, as above, so below, and that the pattern, or spiritual DNA of creation, is replicated into each of the lower aspects that are part of creation. In the same way that a single cell embryo, when in proper balance within the womb, will produce the pattern of the seven spiritual centers embodied in the glands, and the 12 spheres of mind which embody the organs as portrayed in the tree of life within the fetus, it is also true that under the proper conditions, the laws that control all things in this world, the laws of nature and nature's God, will reproduce this same pattern among the people and within a nation, and it is this holographic pattern that brings about the success often associated with American exceptionalism. And in comprehending the laws, deists such as Franklin and Thomas Paine understood that if you created the proper environmental conditions, that not only the necessary expansion of mind would be brought about by the laws, but also great success, which the world could not bring about under the European forms of government. But in order for the laws of God and creation to work to man's greatest benefit, the people had to be free of restraint by both church and state. In the same way that the human father does not directly intervene in the development of the fetus that is forming within the womb of his wife, and that once the initial laws are satisfied that resulted in conception, the evolutionary expansion of the fetus is brought about by the laws. The same is true with respect to an individual, as well as a nation that can manifest the necessary environment for the laws to bring about the evolution of the people within the nation. And it was for this important reason that the federal government was limited to the protection of the nation from outside attackers, and to promote and regulate commerce between the states. That the central federal government has been able to overstep its bounds is because of the failure of the Supreme Court, as well as the ignorance of the laws on the part of our political and religious leaders. What is central to the heightening and enlargement of human consciousness is the development of the 12 spheres of mind which, by their very nature, are often paradoxical opposites that perceive the world differently, and it is in these great differences that are often in conflict with one another that the depth, heightening, and expansion of mind is brought about. Thus, the primary constitutional purpose and obligation of government is to secure the rights of one individual and slash or group to think and live differently without interference from being dominated and in any manner diminished by the other schools of thought. But in order to accomplish this ultra-important purpose, the government itself must not be permitted to be entangled or in support of any of the groups or schools of thought. As deists and Gnostics who understood the laws of creation which they portrayed as the laws of nature and nature's God, the inner core of our constitutional framers understood this. Heightening and enlargement of human consciousness was impossible under a monarchy, a dictator, an imperial regime, or under what has come to be known as communism, socialism, a theocracy, or any type of government where the leaders could dictate the thinking and lifestyle of the people. The total failure of Marxism, whether it takes the form of communism, socialism, secular progressivism, or even linear intellectualism that is taught in our systems of education, is demonstrated in the fact that the central government obstructs the natural workings of the laws as portrayed in the words, the laws of nature and nature's God. And this obstruction of the natural workings of the laws has the effect of suppressing the development of the 12 spheres of mind, which totally inhibits the necessary heightening and enlargement of human consciousness. The enigma of the 12, the laws, and the tree of life. Any true intellectual and slash or spiritual seeker should and must ask the question, why do men see the world differently? Why do they often draw entirely different conclusions about any given subject? What constitutes the great variety and diversity of thought? And ultimately, why is there very little agreement among men? The holographic pattern of creation requires that each fragment or part that makes up the whole is itself imbued with the pattern or spiritual DNA of the whole. The image of the tree of life at the right is in fact the pattern of mind which is holographically replicated into each fragment and part of creation, and not to understand this reality of the pattern ensures that one remains in an unenlightened state. And this is especially true when the implications are recognized. In the same way that the body is formed from a single embryo, and within this single embryo is the pattern of the organs, glands and bodily systems that will begin to form before the fetus can be born, the same pattern that exists within us is holographically true in the outer world within which we are ourselves immersed. But when this reality is properly understood, the implications are so great that no real intellectual or spiritual progress can be made without understanding the effect of the pattern of the tree of life throughout the outer world as we perceive and understand it. In the same way that out of the primary embryonic cell that commences to form the systems that make up the physical body, and the balance of the systems is initiated and brought about within the natural laws that form the body, this same pattern is holographically true in the outer world. At conception, each person represents one cell or thought that forms within the whole. In the same way that the pattern is holographically replicated within each of the parts, each of the 12 spheres are themselves comprised of 12 segments, and from a human consciousness pattern, this segmentation can be brought down to the number used in the scriptures of 144,000. And what this means is that from a human perspective, the consciousness of the mind is comprised of 144,000 points that make up the whole. And it is from this 144,000 that man achieves his great diversity of thought and far-ranging abilities. But out of this pattern, there also exists a reality that few men are able to come to terms with, that is, this same pattern of the 144,000 must also be understood as existing across the spectrum of the consciousness and reality of mankind as a whole, the implications of which undermine virtually all of man's philosophies and traditional religions. The laws of creation as projected into nature and nature's God must maintain the balance across the organism of the body and all its systems in the physical, mental, and spiritual. And in the same way that out of the one embryo forms a segmented body and mind that is comprised of many systems that are both segregated in their individual function, that is, the heart, the lungs, the liver, the kidneys, the brain, and all other organs and glands that make up the whole which formed out of the one embryonic cell, this same segmented reality that is brought about and maintained by the laws, is also true within the scope of mankind as a whole. But on a macro scale, each individual person constitutes one fragmentary cell within the whole, and each single cell within the whole is representative of 1/144.000th. And each 1/144.000th is conceived and brought forth by the laws as existing within the construct of one of the 12 spheres of mind segmented and divided down within the pattern of the 12 within the 12. And that this pattern is brought about and maintained by the laws that hold the tree of life in balance across the spectrum of a multitude of people, all of whom then perceive and see the outer world from a different and often paradoxically conflicting perspective, presents a reality that few men ever come to terms with in their understanding of both themselves and the other people in the world which they share in the gift of life itself. In what is known as the Sermon on the Mount in the Gospels, one of the primary commandments is a prohibition against judging our brothers and sisters. Why? Because each person sees and perceives the world from a different and sometimes conflicting perception and understanding, a perception and understanding that is brought about and maintained by the laws of creation which imbues nature with the objective of maintaining balance and wholeness. Perhaps it can be thought of as the Tower of Babel syndrome on steroids. Therefore, when we judge another, we are in effect not only finding fault with the laws of creation, but we are also judging others who are polarized to a different sphere/fragment within the pattern of the tree of life from the perspective of our own fragmentary perception and understanding. And while empathetic discernment of others is of the utmost importance in the development of mind as manifest in the pattern of the tree of life within us, it is imperative that we understand the difference between discernment and judgment. In the same way that the great variations and diversity of thinking across the spectrum of mankind exists and is maintained by the laws of nature and nature's God, laws of creation, while each fragment within the whole is representative of a fractionated truth, the inherent limitations in the construct of each fragment immerses that individual perception of truth in a sea of confusion and error by virtue of its fractionated reality. While truth exists within the reality of the whole, A fragment that is based upon 1/144.000th of the whole exists in grave error apart from the fullness of the whole. In the 90th chapter of the Gospel of the Nazarenes, this important teaching is preserved. The one truth has many sides, and one sees one side only, another, and some see more than others, according as it is given to them. Behold this crystal, how the one light is manifest in 12 faces, yeah, 4 times 12, and each face reflects one ray of light, and one regards one face, and another, another, but it is the one crystal, and the one light that shines in all. What it is saying is that one truth is divided across the spectrum of the 12, and each person only sees one face of the 12, and when the words, yeah, 4 times 12, is understood as the division of the pattern of the 12 within each of the 12, each person only sees a fragment of the face of the original 12 as portrayed in the 12 faces of the crystal that divides and segments the one truth. And since the perception and understanding of what each person thinks they see as a fragmented 1/144.000th is from a different and often paradoxically different perspective than another person, not only is every person and group bound by error by virtue of their own inherent incompleteness, but their judgment, in contradistinction of discernment, of the perception and understanding of others, inhibits them from advancing beyond a very rudimentary and incomplete reality of mind. Deus, and the homogenization factor. Many of the core constitutional framers of what has come to be the government of the United States were in fact souls who had lived as the original followers of the historical man Jesus in the first century. It must be remembered that the church itself rejected the positions of the original Ebionite Nazarene disciples, that is, they were rejected from one religion as apostates, and from the other as heretics. Gibbon, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, V1, page 416. Even the Epistle of James, who is historically known as the very brother of Jesus, was openly condemned by Martin Luther as an epistle of straw simply because his, Luther's, pagan mindset was incapable of understanding the core gospel principles and spiritual objectives. Only the most irrational blind believers could even embrace the idea that the historical Jesus never discussed God or his relationship to God, which those who he taught and acted as a spiritual guide. So to even suggest that such conversations did not take place, or that the whole of the original gospel theology was not built of both Jesus and his disciples' relationship to God, is simply absurd.